Hello, my friends, and welcome back to yet another episode of Watching the Watchers Live. Merry Christmas special edition. I hope you had an amazing holiday. We certainly did. But just because it's Christmas, well, we still got some holiday goodies that we need to attend to. And of course, there is a lot to get into today. A lot of stuff dropped over the last few days. And we're looking at two stories, although this is the old, I was going to call this show Futility, but we ended up calling it Endgame. So that's old. But we have two things we're going to talk about today. One is Carrie Lake. Of course, the decision came out. Carrie Lake is not going to be the next governor unless she's successful on the appeal. But we've got several different things to look at. One, the under advisement opinion, and then Carrie Lake's next course of action. She says she's going to be appealing this puppy, and we'll see how that will work for her. All of that will be in the first segment. Then in our second segment, we've got Twitter Files 9 that dropped. And on this one, we got Elvis Chan, who is going to be the subject of a lot of these tweets. Of course, this was the FBI agent, the supervisory special agent who worked for the FBI in San Francisco. Twitter Files 9 dropped on 12/24. On Christmas Eve, it's a Christmas miracle. We just get more Twitter files. And so we're going to take a look at the FBI statement. We're also going to look at three different clips, which we've talked about. We've played this clip before, but I just wanted, you know, I wanted to sort of tease this out because there are three things he says in like 90 seconds that are just very much, they were prognosticating what was going to be happening, and or they were forecasting what was going to be happening is the better way to say it. And now it's all coming out in reality because Matt Taibbi dropped Twitter Files 9. And so on this beautiful Christmas, we've got a lot to get to, my friends. And if you want to be a part of the show, the best place to do that is over at watchingthewatchers.locals.com. Celebrating over there, Cindy Cool Guy, Kelly Sal Now. We've got JC the Music Man, Cindy 79, Ken Innitz over there, along with John McGarvey. Paul Mino is literally a shirtless Santa swinging on a Christmas ornament. I mean, this is what it's like in our locals community. Look at this. It's absolutely out of control. And so they're all chatting away over there. Come and check us out at watchingthewatchers.locals.com. And Merry Christmas to everybody over there. A lot of Merry Christmases in the chat. Merry Christmas to Charlie Stewart over on YouTube. Merry Christmas over to John McGarvey and Ken Innitt and Kelly Salnow and JC the Music Man. Michael Swade's on Rumble. He says, Merry Christmas, Robert. Thank you for sharing your Christmas with us. Well, Michael, thank you for sharing your Christmas with me. I'm grateful for that. It's really good to see everybody here today. And, you know, we spend a lot of time together throughout the week and throughout the months and throughout the years. And I just felt right on Christmas. It's good to spend some time with you guys. And I really mean that. So thanks for spending some time here with me. All right. And so an amazing community. Thank you to Rose Four. Thank you to CA Human, who says so many stocking stuffers. I'm grateful for all the super chats that I see coming in. Thank you, guys. All right. And so I want to get this queued up because, boy, man, we spent a lot of time last week on the Carrie Lake trial, and now it's looking like it's over because we have a decision from the judge. And yeah, I was wondering where Lean was in the chat. You know, Lean, and I see Curtis Bartles in the house. What's up, Joy? What's up, The Circle? All right. We've got some, you know, it's good to see everybody. Merry Christmas all around. All right, so let's get right to it. Carrie Lake decision just dropped. The judge deciding that Carrie Lake is not going to be the next governor of Arizona. We are going to go through the full under advisement decision. Of course, we spent the full 2 days on the trial unpacking exactly what happened there. A lot of testimony. Lots of it I thought was lacking. I wanted to see those checkboxes checked. And we went through the two different counts that Carrie Lake was facing. One alleging that there were chain of custody problems. The other was alleging that there was other malfeasance that somebody was manipulating with the printer tabulators and so on. After 2 full days of trial, the judge came out and issued his opinion. We're going to go through it in detail. Why? Because Carrie Lake says she's going to appeal this puppy. Not even waiting around. You see this. She dropped this on Twitter on 12/24 at 11:52 a.m. Carrie Lake posted, she said, my election case provided the world with evidence that proves that our elections are run outside the law. The judge did not rule in our favor. However, for the sake of restoring faith and honesty in our elections, I will appeal his ruling. And so it sounds like she may not have a lot of belief that this is going to go anywhere. But she says, just for the sake of restoring our faith, restoring honesty on our elections, we're going to appeal it. We're going to keep fighting, 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 fighting. So let's see what some bases might be for her appeal when we go through the under advisement decision. And it's not too long. We see here, filed 1224 at 1045 a.m. out of the Maricopa County Superior Court here in Arizona. Shout out. 10-page document. Peter Thompson is the judge who signed off on it. It is Carrie Lake versus Katie Hobbs. We see the lawyers are there. We've got Brian Blem, who was representing Carrie Lake, David Gayona, and many others, a whole slew of people representing the government and Katie Hobbs. Judge Thompson took this matter under advisement at the close of trial. He said, thank you, everybody, for participating, and we're done. Then on Christmas Eve, this dropped. Judge Thompson writes, the court has considered the evidence presented at the evidentiary hearing on December 21 and 22, both of which we covered here in depth, including all the exhibits admitted and the testimony of the witnesses. And we didn't see all of the exhibits. Remember, there were affidavits and declarations that were actually filed under seal, and we never got to unpack those. The judge says the court has also read and considered all 220 affidavits attached to the verified petition. The court is also, which is a lot of affidavits, the court has also considered arguments by counsel, and therefore the court issues the following findings and conclusions of law. Now, a big question that came up in this analysis was sort of what are the standards of proof? Who has to show what? Who has the burden of proof? Who has the obligation to provide the evidence, right? Because Carrie Lake doesn't have much evidence. Let's just be clear about this. Carrie Lake, at this moment, and when she brought this lawsuit, a private citizen, she's got as much power as you or I do. So she doesn't have access to the same materials that the government has. And so we run into this a lot in criminal law. You know, if one of our clients is charged with a DUI, we don't have access to the entire crime lab. We don't know exactly what went on in there or who these people are, how it all works. And so part of our job is to go and investigate it. And they stonewall us at every turn. They say, oh, you don't need that, or you don't need this, or it's just your fishing expedition, so on and so forth. Very similar here, right? Carrie Lake needs access to voter data. And she needs to see all this stuff and inspect that and inspect this. And she really didn't have much access to that. So the question is, how can she sort of prove her case if she can't go and gather evidence? In criminal law, we've got all sorts of obligations, right? You have a confrontation clause, you've got due process and equal protection, constitutional provisions that allow us, enable us to get all sorts of material, right? We've got, you know, Brady rules and so on. But with elections, what are those standards? Is it beyond a reasonable doubt? Is it preponderance of the evidence? Beyond a reasonable doubt, right? That's in criminal law. That's a very high standard. In order to convict somebody, you got to go beyond all reasonable doubt. If there's any doubt about a person's innocence or guilt, and it's based in reason, that person's not guilty, because you got to get beyond a reasonable doubt. Very high standard. So what is the election standard? Let's see what the judge says. Throughout the history of Arizona, the bar to overturn an election on the grounds of misconduct has always been a high one, right? Kind of similar to criminal law, like we were talking about. Citing a case back from 1887, that's old. It says, it is the object of elections to ascertain a free expression of the will of the voters, and no mere irregularity can be considered unless it be shown that the result has been affected by such irregularity. Now, that was a case back from a territory case, right, before Arizona was even a state, which happened in the 1900s. In 1887, they were saying that, you know, this has to be more than a mere irregularity. And what were their elections like back then? I don't think they had printer tabulator malfunctions. So I'm not sure what type of issues they were running into. But even back then, they were finding some mere irregularities with their voting. Okay. And I'm sure it was all in person. So what's going on over there? Long history of this stuff. But the point is, this is the standard. Okay. No mere irregularity. The judge continues. Judge says, our territorial Supreme Court back then agreed in 1898 that it is unwise to lay down any rule by which the certainty and accuracy of an election may be jeopardized by reliance upon any proof affecting such results that is not the most clear and conclusive character, right? So this is old language, most clear and conclusive character. The official election returns are prima facie evidence of the votes actually cast by the electorate. Another case, this is a 1917 case. So now we're getting a little bit closer. And this is saying that the evidence that is just provided by the final votes is enough that satisfies it, right? It's enough evidence of the votes actually cast. The fact that you've got the votes, the returns, that they're saying that is evidence. So the judge says the burden of proof in any election contest is on the challenger. That means it's Carrie Lake's job to prove her claims. This would be like, okay, in a criminal case, in my opinion, this, you know, this analogy can probably be beaten up a bit, but it would almost be like if you were an innocent person and you had to prove your innocence. You have to go and prove your innocence. The government says, we convicted you. We did everything right. Everything's perfect. And you have to challenge that. Well, you don't have access to the crime lab and the blood results, and you don't have access to billions of dollars of, you know, police officers and utilities and gear and all this stuff. You don't have all of that. So it makes it very hard. That's why we have the presumption of innocence. But with elections, we have the presumption of propriety. So the challenger has to really come in and come in hot. Carrie Lake. Now, it's a difficult thing to do, right? It's almost, how is she going to do that when you're alleging fraud and you get certain people up there who are testifying and they don't give you access to anything? In fact, they're still doing their root cause analysis. The duty of specifying and pointing out the alleged irregularities and insufficiencies is a task that should be undertaken by litigants and their counsel, their lawyers, 1948, right? So both sides now, two things. One, Carrie Lake has to actually carry the burden. She's got to prove there was a problem, but also the investigation, the duty of specifying and pointing out the irregularities specifically, they've got to be done by counsel. That's a 1948 case. And so that's a tall order, boy. It's a lot to do, especially if you can't go and just rummage through all the files. It's too bad Elon Musk can't buy the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors and release their emails. We'd see a lot. Now, as for the actions, says the judge, as for the actions of election officials themselves, this court must, you see that in italics, must presume the good faith of their official conduct as a matter of law. So all those people testifying, Valenzuela and Jarrett and all of the other individuals, remember we covered a lot of them. And if we go back through the archive, we see a bunch of them here. Reynaldo Valenzuela, Dr. Kenneth Mayer. We had Richard Barris, the pollster. But these election officials, Reynaldo Valenzuela and Scott Jarrett, these two people, the court is saying we have to presume the good faith of them as a matter of law. It says all reasonable presumptions must favor the validity of an election, and election challengers must prove the elements of their claim by clear and convincing evidence. Very high standard, right? So it's not quite beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's high. The order from the judge, he writes, granting in part Hobbs's motion to dismiss that we read through here. It gave Carrie Lake two independent claims for seeking their requested relief. Two bases, which we covered at length here. One, plaintiff has only these options because election contests are purely statutory and they're dependent upon the statutory provisions for their conduct. Judge says, put another way, Carrie Lake has no freestanding right to challenge election results based on what the plaintiff believes. Carrie Lake can't just file a lawsuit because she believes it was bad, rightly or wrongly, that it went awry on election day. She must, as a matter of law, prove a ground that the legislature has provided for challenging the election, right? She's got to check all of the boxes explicitly. One who would contest an election assumes the burden of showing that this case falls within the terms. The remedy may not be extended. Okay. So the judge is giving us some details to fill in the lines there, but says, Carrie Lake's remaining claims after the judge dismissed the other eight is based on the following grounds. One, misconduct on the part of election boards or any members thereof in any of the counties in creating the canvas for the state election. The trial here was premised on Carrie Lake's theories arising from the second clause concerning an officer making a canvas. Now, the order that came out from the judge allowed the trial to go forward on two bases. One, the claim that ballot on-demand printers, they malfunctioned on election day, that those were intentionally caused and that those changed the outcome. That was count two. And we read through that at length. And in fact, you know, one of my main criticisms of this entire trial and really the presentation by Kari Lake's lawyers was that they didn't get a name out of this. They needed a name specifically. The judge said, I want a name of an individual in count two. The malfeasant person was a covered person. Who was that? Well, we didn't get any names out of it. Could have been Reynaldo Valenzuela. Unlikely. Could have been Scott Jarrett. Maybe more likely because he was there on he was running election day stuff. Right. Who's the boss? Who did he control? Who changed the settings? Who sent the email? And so on. Right. How did you investigate this? What's the final root cause conclusion? And so on. They didn't. I'm not saying that he was responsible for this or that he knew about it or anything, but they didn't even present an alternative name. Nothing. Or even try to blame him for it or blame anybody else. So they didn't check that box. And number two, the claim that Maricopa County violated its own election procedures and chain of custody procedures was another possibility. As outlined in the order that the judge sent over previously, there are four elements to each claim. Plaintiff need to prove by clear and convincing evidence each element, each one of these checkboxes, to be successful in the case. So Kari Lake's got to prove the following. One, that the alleged misconduct, whether the printer irregularities or the failure, was intentional. Now, we got a lot of opinion about that. Remember, Clay Parikh was one of Kari Lake's experts who said, yeah, you can only change those printer settings through script. You've got to bring in somebody else to go in there and change them. And they were testing the day before, and they didn't test any 19-inch ballots. And we also heard from the government, in this case, this was Scott Jarrett, who sort of was not real aware of the 19-inchers the day before. Or maybe he was, and maybe he was lying, you know, on the stand. I don't know. People are asking questions about that. His testimony sort of changed between the 2 days. But the defense didn't hammer him on that, and so he didn't face any real scrutiny on that in court. He's facing a lot of scrutiny on the internet, but not a lot in court. And so all of that continues on. We really got no name out of this. Intentional act, right? Who would have done that? Don't know. So it's a big question on that one. That the misconduct was an intentional act conducted by a person, an officer, somebody participating in the canvass. That the misconduct was intended to change the result of the election. And that the misconduct did change the result of the election. It's a lot. You got to check every one of those. If you miss any one of these boxes, it's game over. So the judge says that it bears mentioning while we're here that because of the requested remedy, which is Kari Lake asking for the set aside of the election, the question that is before the court is of monumental importance to every voter. This is the judge saying, are you asking me to throw out a whole election? Are you serious? All right, let's see. The margin of victory as reported by the official canvass is 17,100 votes. Beyond the scope of a required recount, a court setting such a margin aside, as far as the court is able to determine, has never been done in the history of the United States, says this judge, right? And sort of that was my speculation, but I didn't know that that's official. So apparently this judge probably did the research on that. And yeah, I mean, you know, I've not heard of it. Have you heard of anything like that? I haven't. Which is why this is always, you know, it's always such a tall order. The judges are just not going to interfere with this. This guy doesn't want this hanging around his neck like an albatross for the rest of his life. Now, rightly or wrongly, right? Say that, call that what, classify that decision however you'd like. This challenge also comes after a hotly contested gubernatorial race and an ongoing tumult over election procedures and legitimacy, a far less uncommon occurrence in this history of our country. The judge says this court acknowledges the anger and the frustration of voters who were subjected to inconvenience and confusion at voter centers as technical problems arose in 2022. But the judge says, but this court's duty is not solely to incline an ear to public outcry. And we're not here to listen to your complaints, Arizonans. It is to subject to plaintiff's claims and defendant's actions to the light of the courtroom and the scrutiny of the law, almost like shining a big spotlight on the issue. And so the judge says, we start now. Thompson writes, he says, it was Carrie Lake's burden to establish each element by clear and convincing evidence. If Carrie Lake herself failed to sustain the burden of proof, then the matter is decided. And so the court begins with Carrie Lake's case in chief. Right. And just to illustrate this, you may have heard, you know, in criminal defense law that you might have a case where a defense attorney just sits there, right? He's just kind of twiddling his thumbs and he just lets the prosecution present all of their evidence. And he just says at the end of it, I got no evidence to present, nothing further, judge, right? And the defense attorney just sits there and the judge says, well, you win. And you go, what? What? He didn't even present anything. That's because the prosecutor didn't check the boxes, right? If a defense attorney knows that they can't hit one of the elements, you don't have to present any evidence at all. In fact, Katie Hobbs and her team could have just sat there and said nothing. And based on what we saw at trial, pretty sure Carrie Lake still would have lost because she didn't check the boxes. Now, let's see what the judge says. Here says Mark Sonneclair, who was the lawyer. And let's refresh our recollection with Mr. Sonneclair. He was on day one of the trial, presented as the lawyer who worked for the NSLB. And Mark Sonneclair was this guy. He said that 50% is not minor.
I believe you mentioned that you visited personally about 10 vote centers.
Yes.
And that the other roving attorneys that you were working with, it was a total of about 115 vote centers in total.
Yes.
And that's 115 out of about, I think, 223 vote centers, correct?
That's correct.
So that's a little over half of the vote centers.
I believe it was 52%.
How are you able to characterize what your other the other roving attorneys were experiencing, whether it was similar to what you were experiencing or worse or maybe not as bad? How would you characterize?
Well, I would say that most of the roving attorneys had a similar experience to mine. I can't think of one that had a different experience.
Yeah,
there may be. But for the most part, you know, aggregated together, pretty much everyone had the same experience.
And if somebody were to characterize the events of that day as minor technical difficulties that should be expected in any election, what would you say to that?
I would say that's nonsense. When you have 132, we've been able to document that there were at least 132 vote centers with tabulator problems out of 227, which comes out to about 59%. I don't see how that could be characterized as a small matter.
Yeah, it's not. It's a giant problem. The whole election was problematic, but it was not enough, obviously. Now, let's see what the judge says about Mr. Sonneclair. Judge Thompson writes, he says, the court first considers Mark Sonneclair, roving election attorney with the Republican National Committee. Sonneclair testified that on election day, he went from voter centers on election day all over the place, visited eight of them. He testified that because of his personal knowledge that one, the failure of the tabulators was at multiple locations. He said his own personal estimate of the rate of failure was also provided as evidence. He also talked about the efforts of the varying different degrees of efficacy of Maricopa County techs to fix the tabulators. And also he talked about the frustration of voters in long lines. He testified that the county provided wait times were not accurate and that a much higher number of voter centers suffered from printer tabulator failures than were admitted. Now the court says, the court credits the personal observations of Mr. Sonneclair and does not doubt his knowledge or his veracity. But the court cannot follow Mr. Sonneclair to ascribing intentional misconduct to any party. Sonneclair said at trial that it was common sense that such widespread failures must have been the result of intentional conduct, but this intuition does not square with his own observations. Judge says, for one thing, Mark, he says, county T-techs being sent to troubleshoot and fix the tabulators are not consistent with a scheme by a person to alter the results of an election. Oh. So because they tried to fix it, it doesn't mean that there was any intentionality in the underlying problem. Okay. Mr. Sonneclair testified to nothing that suggested those tech efforts were anything other than best efforts intended to remedy the problem, right? So because they tried to fix it after the fact, right? One person who wrote a script who might have reprogrammed all of the tech, they sent text to go fix it. And that cover papers over the mistake, right? For intentionality. See how this goes? Second, as Sonic Clair himself admitted, he didn't personally observe anything that allowed him to support his intuition that someone had engaged in intentional misconduct. He didn't observe it directly. Third, Sonic Clair admitted he has no technical knowledge that would allow him to determine these things. And lastly, Sonic Clair admitted he had no personal knowledge of any voter being turned away from the polls as a result of the failures. So as far as evidence of misconduct is concerned, the court finds nothing to substantiate plaintiff's claims of intentional misconduct. And there's not even a name, right? We didn't get any names out of there. So even if he thought that it was intentional, right, you got a tribute intent to a person, and we got no names out of him. Heather Honey. You remember Heather Honey. She's a very good OSINT, OS intelligence, open source intelligence individual. Great testimony. From her botched direct exam from the lawyers. She had a PowerPoint slide and everything, and she wasn't even allowed to go through it from her lawyer, okay, from Carrie Lake's lawyer. But okay. Now, Heather Honey, the court brings up her testimony and says, the court next considers Ms. Honey. She's a supply chain auditor, a consultant, who testified primarily concerning chain of custody. The court, again, credits Ms. Honey's observation and personal knowledge of the early voting ballots. As relevant to misconduct, her testimony makes two main points. One, Honey says that Maricopa County did not produce receipt forms for ballot packets. And two, that an employee of Runbeck averred to run that Runbeck employees were allowed to submit 50 ballot packets to friends and family. Of friends and family into the ballot stream. Okay, so as the ballots were being picked up in the courier boxes, Runbeck employees were just saying, well, I got a couple extra ballots. Why don't we just shove them inside? The judge says, again, the court does not doubt Ms. Honey's veracity, but her testimony is of limited use in making a finding that intentional misconduct occurred. For one thing, Ms. Honey agreed during cross-examination that while she has not received the delivery receipt forms, she knows that the forms do in fact exist. She didn't get them, but they exist, right? And because Carrie Lake has to bring the claim, she doesn't really get all that discovery like you might get in a criminal defense case, because you have a right to see the evidence against you in a criminal case. In an election case, it's all still kind of the purview of the government. Now, while Ms. Honey testified that the public records request has not yet been fulfilled, to the extent there is a claim to be made for insufficient production, that claim is not before the court, okay? So Ms. Honey, right, or Carrie Lake, if they're upset that they don't have the records, well, they can file a claim that they didn't get the records to do their investigation. But that's not what we're here for. And as Ms. Honey said, apparently the records do exist. They just haven't been given over yet. And so because Carrie Lake's expert herself agreed that the forms, which are the basis for this claim, they do exist, Carrie Lake cannot point to their absence as a violation of the manual, the election manual. But next, as to the 50 ballot packets that those Runbeck employees were allegedly shoving in the courier boxes, Ms. Honey admitted that neither she nor her contacts with Runbeck had personal knowledge of any permission given by Maricopa County to do anything like that, right? So again, no names of who would have authorized that, no intent by Maricopa County. The court also goes through some additional affidavits, somebody from named Leslie White, somebody named Denise Marie. The White affidavit is less helpful on these points. Ms. White testifies mainly to the limitations of what she was allowed to see as an observer. Okay, so her affidavit's just like, well, you know, I think they were doing this, and I could sort of see that and sort of see that, but Judge says that Leslie expresses worry about the rapid pace of the processes and her limited field of view, but does not point to any violation, nor does counsel draw the court's attention to any violation found in the affidavit. Right, so they're not checking the boxes there. As for Ms. Marie's affidavit, the court must weigh her averment that the family ballots were inserted into the ballot stream against sworn testimony of Mr. Jarrett and Mr. Valenzuela, both those two gentlemen who came in and testified and said, no, none of that was happening. No, we would have never approved any of that. right? These two guys, they actually run the elections and they came in and they said, nope, never authorized anything like that. It's not part of the procedures, and don't believe them. They say they have eyes on the ballot process during their entire time at Runbeck. So the court finds the latter more credible, the election officials, given that Ms. Marie does not even allege anything about the Maricopa County employees' roles in the alleged violation. So who in Maricopa County would have authorized that? Judge says that the combined testimony of multiple officials about the training, the violation, says we can't give that document much weight. Sorry, Ms. Marie. Judge says that in his closing arguments, Carrie Lake's lawyer argues that, quote, it does not make sense, right? And he said that many, many times. It does not make sense. It does not make sense. In fact, I stopped playing his closing argument because that was basically the argument. He says it does not make sense that Maricopa County did not know how many ballots Maricopa County had received on election night. But at trial, it was not Maricopa County's burden to establish its process or the procedure was reasonable, or that it had an accurate unofficial account on election night. Even if the county did bear that burden, failing to carry it would not be enough to set aside the returns. Particularly where Carrie Lake's own witness on this point lacks personal knowledge of the intent of the bad actor, admits that the defendant did in fact generate the documents, and otherwise says that they did sort of otherwise comply with the processes, this court cannot say that plaintiff proved element one of count four. No intent. Judge goes back over to Clay Parikh. Clay Parikh, of course, was Carrie Lake's expert witness. Fun testimony from him. He was the individual who told us that there was a script that was written that updated the ballot settings. Here's what that sounded like. Actually, this is a very long clip. It's at the very end.
It's actually what would be called a print spooler, and it controls the print jobs to allow the printer to take on the load. And as there were multiple site books, this would be the technical use that that laptop should be used for.
Is there any way, in your opinion, for a 19-inch ballot image to be projected on a 20-inch ballot by accident?
No, sir.
Why not?
Because the settings and the configurations and the procedures that are used cannot allow that. These are not a bump up against the printer and the settings change. There are security configurations. I've reviewed the evidence and the printers are configured via script, which by any large organization that has to do multiple systems is a standard. This takes away the human error of somebody miscoding in the instructions either on the printer.
So somebody has to run the script. Somebody has to intentionally install, you know, say go and update all the settings. So the next question, of course, you know, after that testimony would be to go over to the government and say, who's responsible for writing your scripts? Is that true? Do you guys actually update your printers by script? Okay, when was the last time you updated them? Who authorized that? Did you talk to that person, that individual? Okay, we'd like to talk to him. Why has he not been disclosed? Why is he not a witness that was called by Carrie Lake's lawyers? I have no idea. But anyways, these two guys, right, are also involved in that. And when they're brought up for cross-examination, we don't get really any questions out of them, right? No follow-up on Clay's opinion. Hey, Scott Jarrett, he said, our expert said it's updated by scripts. Is that true? Who wrote those scripts? We didn't get many questions about it, but let's see what the judge says about Clay. He writes, Mr. Parikh has an impressive technical background as a cybersecurity expert for Northrop Grumman. The court again credits his substantial experience and his personal knowledge as far as it goes. Now, his primary contention was that the printer errors he saw reflected in the law. He saw a printing of a 19-inch ballot on a 20-inch paper ballot. Must have been done intentionally, either by overriding the image file that was sent from the laptop to the printer or from the ballot image definition site, right? When you send a Word document over to the printer, you say, can you please print it right here and put it on 8.5 by 11? Or if you're doing an envelope, put it on an envelope and print it this way. You send the instructions to the printer. Either those instructions were changed in the software, or sometimes you just send a document over to the printer. You just say, print this. I don't care what happens with it. Print it. And the printer says, okay, fine. 8.5 by 11. You've got it. It just spits it right out. Or you printed, you changed the defaults on the printer side. Either way, it's a change, right? That was Parikh's argument. However, if the ballot definitions were changed, says the judge, it stands to reason that every ballot for that particular definition printed on every machine would be affected and printed incorrectly. As Kerry Lake's next witness indicates, that was not the case on Election Day. In either event, Mr. Parikh acknowledged he had no personal knowledge of any intent behind what he believes to be the error. He said that they had to update them via script, which means somebody made the change intentionally. But the judge is being very careful with that one. Okay, and I think where this is going is the judge is essentially saying that there was no person. There was an error. There was a script. There was something that happened. But who was the person who intended that to happen, and where did the intent come from? The court notes that Mr. Parikh also acknowledged a fact admitted by several of Kerry Lake's witnesses that any ballot that could not be read due to the printer or tabulator failure could be submitted for ballot duplication and adjudication for door three. Plaintiff's own expert, meaning Kerry Lake's, acknowledged that a ballot that was unable to be read at the vote center could be deposited by a voter, duplicated by a bipartisan board onto a readable ballot, and in the final analysis, ultimately counted, right? This is the harmless error provision. Doesn't matter. It's harmless error. It should be counted, and it's going to be counted anyway, so who cares? Judge says, therefore, Kerry Lake's expert on this point admitted that the voters who suffered from tabulator rejections would nevertheless have their votes counted. Italics. This, at a minimum, means that the actual impact element of count two could not be proven, the impact element. The printer failures did not actually affect the results of the election. And so the judge says further, as to the intent elements, the court must pair its consideration of Parikh's testimony with another witness called David Betancourt. David Betancourt is a temporary employee of Maricopa County, and we saw his testimony. He was the gentleman who said that it was madness and chaos, and he shared with us the text messages, many, many text messages showing all sorts of problems on Election Day. And we read through many of these, right? Lots of misreads. We're running at about 50% acceptance. Inspector from Mountainside in Tempe called and says, tabulator is not accepting overvotes, even though they're pressing the overvote buttons, and so on. Judge goes through his testimony and says, Mr. Betancourt was a temporary employee of Maricopa County called a T-Tech, called by Kerry Lake to testify about the technical issues. As relevant here, the judge says, Mr. Betancourt testified that there were, in fact, multiple technical issues on Election Day. He said that these were solved through a number of various means. One, taking out the toner and ink cartridges and shaking them, which is a solution that most of us have tried. Two, cleaning the corona wire. Three, letting the printers warm up, cleaning out the tabulators. Number four, five, adjusting the printer settings. Man, a whole lot of different things that went wrong. It is of note, apart from five, that none of these solutions implicates a ballot manner suggesting intent. All of those sound like just regular office problems. Oh, got to clean the tabulators, adjust the printer settings, got to shake them a little bit, bang it on the side, turn it off, turn it on again, you know, the whole deal. Adjusting the settings. And none of that sounds like intent. It seems like just a bunch of innocent problems happening. Mr. Betancourt testified that each of these on-site actions were successful to varying degrees, with shaking the toner cartridge being the most effective. Oh, that's all this was. It was just shaking toner cartridges. Judge says, it's worth repeating that ballots that could not be read by the tabulator immediately because of the printer settings could be deposited in door three and tabulated later. So it's harmless error, doesn't matter. Judge says that the Maricopa County tech testified that not only did he lack knowledge of any other election worker engaging in intentional misconduct, right? He was asked during cross-examination, did you screw this up? Did you ruin this election? He says, no, I didn't do it. Did you see anybody else screw this up and ruin this election? No, I didn't see anybody. Does anybody want to come forward? Anybody want to come forward and be charged with multiple felonies and tell us that you screwed this election up? No, that's weird. Gosh, it's weird. There's no witnesses to talk about this. Strange. but further testified that T-Tex he worked with diligently and expeditiously troubleshot each problem as they arose. And this is what the government was presenting. They were saying, we had people trying to fix this all over the place. What are you talking about? How could we want this to go off the rails when we want the problem solved immediately? We want them fixed like around 2 o'clock after the election's mostly over. They say that they wanted to troubleshoot the problems. They were doing so in a frenetic election day environment. And Kerry Lake's own witnesses testified before this court that the printer failures were largely the result of unforeseen mechanical failures. The judge brings in our friend Richard Barris. He's all over the internet. Make sure you're following him at @peoples_pundit. He's on YouTube too, right next door. Richard Barris is here. The judge says about Richard Barris, he says, Mr. Barris testified as the director of Big Data Poll. He testified that as a result of the printer failures, a number of voters were disenfranchised. And he opined, says the judge, that this change resulted in Kerry Lake losing the election. He testified that he knew this was because of the decreased response rates to his exit poll for the general election. The court will, with respect, put aside the ongoing internecine fights amongst pollsters and political scientists as to the methodology and the reliability of what they do. Indeed, giving weight and all due credit to Mr. Barris, he does not prove element 4, an actual effect on the election. Because it's just speculative, right? It's just him saying that this is what I think, this is what I am getting, this is what I have seen in the numbers, but it's actual effect. Like, they got to go find some votes. Specific buckets of identifiable votes. Bucket from chain of custody, transfer courier, you know, item 37, 55, 12, whatever that batch is. Further, Mr. Barris admitted at trial that nobody can give a specific number of votes who were put off from voting on election day, which is true. Right. And this is a big point. This is what I thought really, you know, if we lived in a country that cared about process, right, like an election going appropriately so that everybody trusts the outcome. The fact that you can't quantify the people who didn't show up to vote because of the delays, you can't put a number on that. Now, the government tried to do that, right? They tried to sort of argue in circles a little bit, or actually narrow the hula hoop when they brought out this guy, Dr. Kenneth Mayer. He told us that the people who showed up on election day, who checked in, they all voted, most of them. He identified 100 or 110 different ballots of those people who checked in and then left without casting a ballot. They said, F this, I'm done. But what we didn't hear is the people who didn't check in. How many people drove by at 6 a.m., 8 a.m., 10 a.m., 12 a.m., saw the lines and didn't go vote? They had to pick their kid up from school. They had a meeting they were late for or whatever. Or they just thought Kerry Lake's going to win, so I guess I'll just stay home. I was intending to go vote and I didn't go vote. That's voter suppression by anybody's measure. And if you brought this up in Georgia and this was happening to Stacey Abrams' constituents, she'd have a different opinion. She'd agree with us here. But because it's Kerry Lake and it's a bunch of Kerry Lake voters and it's Arizona and it's, you know, they're happy as hell it's going blue, nobody cares. In fact, I think the Republicans are even happy about this, right? Doug Ducey and the rest of the conservatives here, many of them would rather see their team lose than see another star player win the game. Okay. Doug Ducey got sidelined. Everybody's being backbenched now. Kerry Lake's the new star of the team. They don't like that. So they'd rather their whole team lose the game and have the other team win than have a star player like Kerry Lake win. So they all shut their mouths and everybody gets quiet about this. But there's no number at the top of the funnel. How many people were suppressed or discouraged, disenfranchised at the outset? Don't know. Richard Barris was brought in to try to quantify that for us using data that's outside of the system. Exit poll, right? Does the government know? Do they have a number on this? No, because they're not tracking you to go to the polls and so on. So you have to use external data to get that number. And the government didn't provide it. But guess what? They're not required to provide it. It's Kerry Lake's burden. So they did the best they could. They brought in Richard Barris. He says nobody can give a specific number. Thus, they write, even if Kerry Lake proved elements 1 through 3 by clear and convincing evidence, the truth of this statement alone dooms element number 4. because you can't prove that number. And the judge wants a specific number. No election in Arizona has ever been set aside. No result modified because of a statistical estimate. In this court's view, it's a quantum leap to go from analogizing cases where malfeasance was precisely quantified such that the court could provide a remedy. In other words, we've identified 17,200 votes that were illegal, which allows us to reverse this thing. A hard number from specific batches and buckets. The judge says, no, we can't do that. You want us to go from this estimate to setting aside a result where the result of the alleged malfeasance is itself unknown? Judge says no. In cases where, for instance, a proportionality method was used, it has been to remedy a known number of illegal votes cast in unknown proportions. Judge takes us back to another 1989 case. But election contests are decided by votes, not by polling responses, and the court has found no authority suggesting that exit polling ought to be used in this manner. Given that exit polling is done after a vote has been cast, the weight of authority seems to be contrary to this proposition. Right? It's a good effort, right? I thought, you know, it's about the only thing you can do is to bring in somebody like a pollster like this to quantify that number. But it was a long shot from the beginning because the judge wanted, he told us, a specific articulable number. Judge gets to it. He says, indeed, to the extent that a range of outcomes was suggested by Barris, he suggested that with his expected turnout increase on election day, says that about 25 to 40,000 votes would have impacted this. It could be between a 2,000 vote margin for Hobbs to a 4,000 vote margin for Kerry Lakes. So taking Mr. Barris's claims at face value, this does not nearly approach the degree of precision that would provide clear and convincing evidence that this was the result of the printer failures. Judge says, well, while this court, even in the absence of a controlling authority, is hesitant to state that statistical evidence is always insufficient, what the judge is saying is that even according to Richard Barris's testimony, the current winner still had a good chance of winning anyway. And so you can't do much with that. Judge says that Mr. Barris cannot say, and further, there was no evidence at trial, that these voters were turned away or refused a ballot. These were voters who elected not to vote, whether at a vote center due to long lines or due to media coverage of chaos on election day or any other of unknown reasons, right? So the fact that it was basically, you know, it was almost impossible to vote that election morning at certain locations, that's not voter suppression. Actually, the judge is not making that argument because voter suppression is not the threshold. Right. It's not the standard. Now, you and I know that that's clearly voter suppression. Right. If that was happening to Democrats, like, for example, if we just said, well, you know, there was chaos on election day at Runbeck when we were counting the electoral ballots, there was chaos in the printer scanners that were scanning all of the early voting ballots, not the electoral. Right. All early voting ballots that came in from largely Democrats, when we were counting them on the printer scanner machines, there was chaos there. Whoa, whoa. It was madness, but don't worry about it. There was, you know, some problems and there were a bunch of techs, you know, scrambling and everybody was freaking out, but don't worry about it. You can trust us. Everything is fine, right? They're different standards. They're saying that Barris provided some good speculative evidence, but not enough to close that gap. None of these constitutes direct evidence permitting the court's intervention. Barris's testimony does not show by clear and convincing evidence that there was misconduct around the printers. Therefore, it doesn't fit. The judge says, we have to talk about the intentional misconduct standard. Now, the court makes the following observations about Kerry Lake's case as a general matter. Every one of Kerry Lake's witnesses, and for that matter, the defendant's witnesses as well, Hobbs's, the government, was asked about any personal knowledge of both intentional misconduct and intentional misconduct directed at the impact to impact the outcome of the election. Every single witness before the court disclaimed any personal knowledge of such misconduct. Yeah, we were waiting for a name the whole trial. One name, just one. The court cannot accept speculation or conjecture in place of clear and convincing evidence. The closest that Kerry Lake claimed to making an argument for quantifiable changes resulting from misconduct was Ms. Marie's affidavit, as discussed by Ms. Honey. Again, she states that Runbeck election employees were permitted to introduce 50 ballots of family members into the stream. Great. Guess what? We've got an employee that would have a name, presumably. We've got a number 50 ballots, great. We have a quantifiable amount. We have some malfeasance, right? Misconduct, inserting the ballots into the stream, misconduct. That's another element. The question about the 50 would be, does that impact the outcome of the election? Obviously not. Was it done with the intent to impact the outcome of the election? Probably not, because it's only 50 ballots. But even that is not sufficient. Such a claim, if the court accepted the affidavit at face value, would be misconduct, but it would not come close to clear and convincing evidence that the outcome was affected. It's only 50 ballots. Who cares, right? Though again, now we care, I care, but the court doesn't care. I'm going to throw out a whole election because somebody opened up a zipper and shoved in 50 ballots. Not going to do that. Though again, weighing her affidavit against other testimony, the court does not give the affidavit much weight. They write, Carrie Lake failed to provide enough evidence with which the court could find for her on either count by clear and convincing evidence. And to the extent that certain claims are contradicted by the defendant's case in chief, it's unnecessary to go into extensive detail, but a few points are worth noting. They write, judge says, as Ray Valenzuela, co-director of elections, said, there was no direction, no permission was given to Runbeck to allow them to do that. Scott Jarrett, also another co-director, and Stephen Richer, county recorder, each testified that Maricopa County election workers are trained to follow the rules and that to their knowledge, they did. As noted above, Valenzuela and Jarrett testified that Maricopa County employees were observing the ballots at each stage in the process. We were watching everything. Carrie Lake brought forward no evidence to contradict that. Judge says it bears mentioning that election workers themselves were attested to by both plaintiffs' witnesses and defendants' witnesses about being dedicated to performing their role with integrity. Not perfectly, as no system is perfect, but more than sufficient to comply with the law and conduct a valid election. Therefore, the judge issues findings of fact and conclusions of law, saying, as to count two, Carrie Lake, the allegation that there was illegal printers and tabulator configurations, the court does not find that there was evidence of misconduct. The court does not find that such misconduct was committed by an officer of Maricopa. The court does not find that misconduct was intended to affect the result of the election, and similarly, no finding that there was any misconduct that did, in fact, affect the outcome. A person, misconduct, intending to adjust the outcome, did, in fact, adjust the outcome. 0 for 0 on that one. Count 4, chain of custody, same thing. Court, no clear and convincing evidence of misconduct. Not done by an officer, not done with the intention of affecting the outcome of the election, and not done, in fact, impacting the outcome of the election. So the judge says, in conclusion, it is ordered, confirming the election of Katie Hobbs as Arizona governor-elect. Oh, gross. Oh, man, that felt horrible to read. Ah, yeah, sick. Taste in my mouth. Oh, gosh. All right, let's carry on here. The court notes the representations of the county defendants that a motion for sanctions against Carrie Lake is going to be coming soon, too. And it's further ordered that a statement of costs, including compensation of inspectors and so on, is going to be filed Monday, December 26th, tomorrow. And any motion for sanctions also must be filed by 8 a.m. tomorrow, and any response by 5 p.m. tomorrow on Monday. So we'll have some more motions for sanctions tomorrow, which will be fun. So hopefully all those board of directors are fervently typing away on their motions for sanctions right now to get that all dropped over in the court tomorrow. Merry Christmas, everybody. Arizona. Bah humbug. The Grinch just came and stole our Arizona from us. Well, that, my friends, is it for the Carrie Lake decision. Not a good decision. Here in Arizona, we've got to live with that garbage, unfortunately. And of course, if you are in Arizona and you happen to know anybody charged with a crime, there's our law firm and our phone number if you do need some help. But Carrie Lake is going to be appealing this. You see here, she's got an appeal likely already pending. Her lawyers are going to be reviewing the record. I am not optimistic about the appeal because I agree with the judge. I don't think that she proved those elements. Now, I have a disagreement with the law. My opinion on this is that the mere suppression of votes on election day is sort of enough evidence you need. There's a concept I was thinking about in the law called re ipsa loc. This is an old Latin phrase. Nobody knows how to say it. Re ipsa loquitur is the thing. And it's an interesting phrase in the law. People call it re ipsa loc or res ipsa loquitur. A lot of people say it differently. It comes from tort law, but it basically means the thing speaks for itself. Okay, the thing speaks for itself. It's a doctrine in common law where a court can infer negligence from the very nature of an accident or an injury, right? You don't even need direct evidence because the fact that it happened means there was a catastrophe, right? It's not something that applies in election law. I think that if you have an election where a giant percentage of the electoral polling places are problematic, it kind of speaks for itself. The thing speaks for itself. In tort law, right, if there's an accident that happens and it's such an obvious accident, it's like you don't need to prove that somebody was negligent because the accident happened, right? It's such a disaster that there's not even a case to debate. So here, for example, here's a fictitious example. John Doe is injured when an elevator he has entered plunges several floors and stops abruptly. Okay, he's in the elevator. The elevator just falls. Do we need to prove that there was an accident that occurred? No, because the elevator fell. So, like, do you need to prove that the elevator company or the building manager was negligent? No, because the elevator fell. Jane's Corporation is built, you know, responsible for maintaining the elevator. John sues Jane and so on. The court says John does not have to prove anything beyond the fall. If you fell, that's enough because the elevator malfunctioned. Jane was responsible for the elevator. Jane's Corporation is responsible for the fall, right? I think the law of election should be more closely, you know, aligned with some of these principles because in this situation, boy, we had a disaster in Arizona. The whole country knows it. The thing speaks for itself. The judge is going to turn himself into a pretzel to hold the election and to you know, comply with the law. And the judge's opinion, I think, is actually right, you know, because Carrie Lake didn't prove the elements as written by law. But the law is kind of ridiculous. The thing speaks for itself. Re ipsa loc. In Arizona, the election was a disaster. We all know it. And we'll see how Katie Hobbs, new reign of terror is as she takes over. But we will, of course, continue to cover all of this news and more. Thank you for liking this video wherever it is you're watching. Thank you for subscribing. And Merry Christmas wherever you're tuning in from. All right, my friends. Now we're jumping into the next segment. Soon as I get this cord properly situated so it stops falling all over the place. Having a weird cord day today. All right. But now we're going over to Twitter Files 9, baby, because it's going to be a lot of fun here. And let's take just a short beverage break because we don't want to get dehydrated. Wherever it is on this beautiful Christmas, my friends, cheers to you celebrating. All right, you see this person right here on the screen. And we're going to dive right into it. Now, do I have this queued up? Let's make sure we got Taibbi's thread posted up here before we start the segment. Twitter Files 9 just dropped, and as usual, we've got more disgusting behavior from the U.S. government and our intelligence agencies, as they trample all over our civil rights. I can't even speak. I'm so irritated. Twitter Files 9. FBI came out, responded to the previous Twitter files, and they are disavowing all of it. They wrote for us, they say, it is unfortunate that people like us who read the Twitter files, that conspiracy theorists and others are feeding the American public information with the sole purpose of attempting to discredit the agency. It's conspiracy theories? What? Well, we're going to look at some direct emails of Twitter and FBI and this guy, Elvis Chan, who we're going to learn more about. Matt Taibbi is going to deconstruct that. But first, let's take a look at this individual, Elvis Chan himself, because he is going to be the subject of Twitter Files 8 in great detail. And we've already heard from him, but just to refresh our recollection, Elvis Chan, former liaison to Twitter, working out of the San Francisco office, supervisory special agent, colluding with the big tech companies.
What are your cybersecurity concerns regarding foreign influence?
So there are really two things that I'm personally very concerned about, and it kind of looks like a rehash of the 2016 election. Number one, I'm really worried about more misinformation campaigns from the Russian government, perhaps from other foreign state actors. And then the second thing is I'm worried that there are data breaches either at private or public organizations that we're not aware of yet, and that information is going to start leaking as the campaign season really picks up.
Yeah, it would be a real big problem if stuff started leaking, like Hunter Biden's laptop. Okay, he was talking about that in 2018. Pre-swading, pre-conditioning the world and all of the big tech companies to be on high alert for a Hunter Biden drop. And you also caught at the beginning there that he's still also concerned about the Russians who in 2016 basically did nothing to adjust the outcome of the election, right? Marginal involvement, if that, if you even want to attribute anything to them. But here, right, they're ultra concerned about that. And so he's going to be dedicated for the next several years to making sure that that they take full control of the big tech companies. In fact, as far back as 2018, they were already working with many of these big tech platforms. This is Elvis Chan admitting that they're colluding with the social media companies to censor Americans.
Now, you're working with social media companies now on this issue. Is that correct?
That is correct. We're working with lots of different types of companies.
Lots
of them. The vulnerabilities that you see or concern you?
I think the things that really worry me the most is the more successful a social media company is, the larger they are, the more data that they have. And they have some really smart, competent folks, and they have some really good machine learning and artificial intelligence. But at the end of the day, looking for these cyber threat actors is like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, so you have to go identify them at the FBI and then funnel them back over to Twitter so that you can censor them. You know, these threat actors, like people who are making jokes about elections on Wednesdays and stuff like that, you know, jokes, satire, people mocking the entire process. FBI says these are big threat actors, and they were literally notifying Twitter through a private platform called Teleport. One final clip from Elvis Chan before we jump into Twitter Files 9, because he is the subject of these. Bolster the defenses of these tech platforms. Elvis Chan says they're not strong enough. Facebook, Twitter, Google, they're not intelligent enough. So we have to bolster their security with the strong arm of the FBI.
What's the FBI doing to help these organizations to bolster their defenses?
So specifically with certain social media companies and platforms, we are providing them with classified briefings.
Whoa, classified
on the specific
briefings.
Threat actors that may be on their platforms. We're also sharing indicators of compromise,
wow.
TTPs, you know, tools, tactics, and processes that mm-hmm. can help them safeguard their platforms.
Okay, so they're giving actual classified briefings. They're giving procedures, processes. We've already covered in the many other Twitter files here on this channel the extent of the commingling of these organizations, the FBI, Twitter, and others. All of that to be said, we now jump into the Twitter files from Matt Taibbi at mtaibbi on Twitter. Taibbi writes, Twitter Files 9, entitled Twitter and, quote, other government agencies. Taibbi tells us, after weeks of Twitter files reports detailing close coordination between the FBI and Twitter in moderating social media, the FBI issued a statement on Wednesday, the one we just looked at. Taibbi says it didn't refute any of the allegations. Instead, it decried the conspiracy theorists publishing misinformation whose sole aim is to discredit the agency. Highlighting it here for us, we see the FBI response. The men and women of the FBI work every day to protect the American public. It's unfortunate that conspiracy theorists and others are feeding the American public misinformation with the sole purpose of attempting to discredit the agency. Yikes, that's a pretty bad statement. Okay, because the conspiracy theorists are sharing your emails. It's not actually misinformation because it's your emails We got to see you requesting people get censored off the internet through your emails. So it's actually truth. So if you are the person who calls everything misinformation, especially misinformation that makes you look bad, people are going to start to discredit your claims of what misinformation is. They're going to say, oh, everything's misinformation. And it seems like only the things that are harmful to your narrative are now misinformation, including the truth, which is leaked out with this, your emails attached to it. Okay. So Taibbi continues. He says, they must think us unambitious if our, quote, sole aim is to discredit the FBI. They've already done that, by the way. We have been making fun of them here for years. They play Where's Waldo, searching for the January Sixers. They investigate people for Legos, for having Legos of the Capitol building. They fraudulently entrap people into other crimes. And I think that they were either involved in January 6th or they were catastrophically incompetent. Pick one. So Matt says, after all, there's a whole range of government agencies to discredit themselves in the Twitter files. Why would we stop with this one? The files show that the FBI is acting as a doorman to a vast program of social media surveillance and censorship, encompassing agencies across the federal government, from the State Department to the Pentagon to the CIA. The operation is far bigger than the reported 80 members of the Foreign Influence Task Force, the FITIF, which also facilitates requests from a wide array of smaller actors, from local cops to media to state governments. Twitter had so much contact with so many agencies that executives lost track. Is today the DOD, the Department of Defense, and tomorrow the FBI? Is it the weekly call? Or is it the monthly meeting? It was dizzying. They've got so many agencies, so little time. Here's what the Slack messages look like, or the emails. Yoel Roth, the former head of trust and safety, who nobody trusts and seemed to be unsafe on his watch. But he's there. He says that on Monday, somebody sends him an email. Yoel, should the prep call be with you at someone and someone? Thanks. Yoel says, for the DOD? No, that's a different group. We'll reply to that in a second. Hope you're doing well. Would it be possible for you to add so-and-so and so-and-so to the invite for the monthly U.S. government industry call? Thanks, from Yoel. A chief end result, says Matt, was that the thousands of official quote reports flowed from Twitter to Twitter from all over, came through the task forces and through FBI's San Francisco field office. Guess who ran the San Francisco office? That's right, Elvis Chan, the guy we just listened to. On June 29, 2020, San Francisco FBI agent Elvis Chan wrote a pair of Twitter execs asking if he could invite an OGA to an upcoming conference. June 29th, 11:24 a.m. Remember, the election's coming up in just a couple of months. Elvis Chan sends a letter over to Stacia and somebody else at FBI.gov. Now, I don't know if this is a conspiracy theorist email here. Does this look like a conspiracy theorist email? It has a date and time and name, and FBI.gov looks like it's probably good information. And it looks like it came from Elvis Chan, who works at the FBI, or did. It says, hey, Stacia, I wanted to follow up to see if I could forward this invitation from to an OGA. Specifically, the people from Blank's former employer were inquiring. Hope all is well. Thanks. OGA, according to Matt, means other government organization, which is a weird acronym, because other government organization is OGO, not OGA, but okay. Maybe other government agency or something. There, other government agency there. It can be a euphemism for the CIA, according to multiple former intelligence officials and contractors. One of them chuckled. They think it's mysterious, but it's just conspicuous, right? They call it OGA, a.k.a. the CIA. Got it. Other government agency, the place where I worked for 27 years, says retired CIA officer Ray McGovern, right? CIA officer said the other government agency. We don't talk about that one. It was an open secret at Twitter that one of its executives was ex-CIA, which is why Chan referred to that executive as a former employer. The first Twitter executive abandoned any pretense to stealth and emailed that the employee used to work for the CIA. So that's an Elvis question. Monday, June 29th, 2:29 p.m., Twitter email. It says, "Hey, Stacia, look, I got no involvement here, okay? I leave this to you to respond. Blank used to work for the CIA." Redacted, right there. Redacted used to work for the CIA. So that is Elvis's question. He works for the FBI. He knows all about the other government agency. And so talk to him. Stacia is the senior legal executive. She's pretty alert. She stood out among other Twitter leaders. She replied, "I know. And I thought my silence was understood." She writes back, June 29th, 2:45 p.m., says, "I know. Let me see if it is publicly announced, and I will tell him that. I thought my silence was understood. We don't talk about the CIA." So Stacia then passes on the conference details to a recently hired ex-FBI lawyer, Jim Baker, formerly from the Sussman trial, formerly at the FBI. Stacia forwards this to Jim Baker, July 8th, 9:22 in the morning. Subject is Info Ops Conference with Carnegie. Stacia says, "Hey, Jim, we got the Sunlight Conference tomorrow. No need for you to attend. Carnegie is doing the heavy lift. I offered to assist Nick and Yoel, but there are no academic papers to review or anything. I was involved in the early scoping of the joint project as well. I invited the FBI, and I believe that the CIA will virtually attend too. Please let me know if you have any questions." So two Twitter executives, Jim Baker, former FBI lawyer, is now meeting again with the FBI. It's just a big revolving door. Leave the FBI, go over to the other intelligence operation, which is called Twitter. They are now meeting. "I invited the CIA virtually as well, but you don't need to come." Now, the government was in constant contact, not just with Twitter, but with virtually every major tech firm. We just get to open the doors inside the Twitterverse. But what's happening on YouTube, where we're right now, right? What are they doing to all of the stories? What's Google doing in the search results? What's Facebook doing on Instagram and everywhere else? Facebook, Microsoft, Verizon, Reddit, Pinterest, many others. Industry players had regular meetings with the government. One of the most common forums was a regular meeting of the multi-agency FITIF, the Foreign Influence Task Force, attended by spates of executives, FBI personnel, and nearly always one or two attendees marked OGA, Other Government Agency, aka CIA. Elvis Chan sends this letter August 14, 2020. Look at all of these feds on here. Ugh. Gosh, this is disgusting. You see here, FBI, 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 Yoel Roth. Look at all these FBI agents, man, on this one meeting. San Francisco, CD, PH, I don't know if that's Phoenix or Philadelphia. We've got CD, OGC, OGA, OGA in highlights, couple CIA officers in this meeting. Yoel Roth's in this meeting. Stacia Cardill is in this meeting. We have another Twitter user who's in this meeting, but I don't know who that is. Lots of feds. Gross. They also say that the meeting agendas virtually always included, at or near the beginning, an OGA briefing. CIA. Usually about foreign matters. Put a pin in that, says Matt. Here's the email. July 30th. From Elvis Chan. To 20 people, all. "Please forward this to whomever you deem appropriate. The agenda: Russian status, IRA update. We also have an OGA briefing," which apparently means other government agency, which apparently means the CIA. APT 28, we've got a China status about PRC and a APT 31. We've got a global status about Iran, Venezuela, North Korea. And we've got planning for the elections down there at the bottom. Isn't that beautiful? On July 30th, just a short couple months before the big election between Trump and Biden. What's the FBI's posture? Better tell you about that. What's your posture? Better talk about that one. and information sharing channels and methods so that we can cooperate and coordinate openly. So when we need to send you something we need removed, you're on it. Another OGA briefing, that one was on August 14th. So two meetings back to back, 2 weeks apart, August 14th, same thing. OGA briefing. Now, we talked some time ago in an earlier Twitter file about something called state action. When the government is taking over an industry or putting pressure on an industry or essentially subsuming that industry, that makes that industry or that company or that actor or that entity, whatever it is, an extension of the government. It makes them a state actor. So that makes Twitter's suppression of our free speech, the government's suppression of our free speech, it makes it actionable. It makes it a constitutional violation. This is the federal government through the FBI and apparently the CIA and other agencies cooperating, or I would say co-opting Twitter for their own purpose, to give them secret intelligence briefs and temporary security clearances and all sorts of insane things. Another email, July 16th, from Elvis, says, "Hi, Stacia. I know it's bananas right there, not right now over there, but I'm wondering if we can get something on the calendar for the next round of the FITIF meetings. Here are the open dates and times which are left: Tuesday, August 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th. The tentative agenda is as follows. An OGA briefing, July 16th, software and influence campaign against Ukraine." They're giving Ukraine updates? July 16, 2020, which is very interesting because, yeah, the invasion of Ukraine was on February 24th, 2022. So they were briefing Twitter on influence campaigns against Ukraine in July 2020, 2 years before the invasion started. Wonder, that must have been those Russians again, huh? Yeah, okay, so China status, global status, and planning for U.S. elections, right? Another brief, and these are about 2 weeks apart is what it's looking like. Yeah, they're 2 weeks apart, almost exactly. Okay, this one came out July 16th. This one is July 30th, and then this one is August 14th. So every 2 weeks, they get election updates on what to do about the election. What a scam. Despite its official remit being foreign influence, the FITIF and the SFSBI field office became a conduit for mountains of domestic moderation requests from state governments and even local police. Yeah, how is this, you know, planning for elections? Like, those are domestic. So is it like all of this is global? Okay, Russia, China, and so on. But we're having conversations about Russia, China, and elections on Twitter. So, okay, the Russian status, or if we're concerned about Ukraine influence campaigns against Ukraine, are you allowed to talk about that on Twitter? Like, in other words, this is a foreign influence task force, okay, but they're going to be censoring and talking about speech that Americans have something to say about. So are they going to be censoring Americans' domestic speech as a result of their foreign influence task force? Because that seems insane. Let's carry on. Despite it being foreign, you see, that's not the truth. There is a lot domestic as well. Elvis sent over to Stacia November 5th, 2020. Oh, no. We're getting really close to that election date. "Hi, Stacia." Elvis says, "The FBI Minneapolis requested that I put you in touch with Lieutenant Hoff about some recent activities, which I provided below. I'll let the two of you take it from here. Thanks. Twitter. TC Park Responder, Lieutenant John Hoff, Strategic Information Center at a Minneapolis Police Department." Oh my goodness. I wonder what those tweets are. "Many requests arrived via teleporter, a one-way platform in which many communications were timed to vanish because they don't want you to see their censorious speech. They don't want you to catch them violating your constitutional rights. Here is what one screenshot looked like. You've been granted access to download this from teleporter. The link's going to remain valid through this time. FBI San Francisco election EOC threat intel. Download it before it expires soon. Link vaporizes. especially as the election approached, says Matt, in 2020. The FITF FBI overwhelmed Twitter with these requests. They sent lists of hundreds of problems accounts. July 20th, 11:44 a.m., Elvis Chan. He says, the article and the names that are associated with the NYO Twitter request. Hey, Twitter folks, could you see below from our FITF global unit and let us know what you think? Thanks. Here's the list. Lots of URLs. This is what Twitter is doing. Right. And at this moment in time, they don't have to play Where's Waldo yet with the J6ers. So they're bored. They're playing Where's Waldo with another modality. This time it's Twitter. And you can see they're just out there all day, just scrolling around. Oh, terrorist. Oh, insurrectionist. Oh, white supremacist. Oh, domestic violent extremist. Oh, election joker. That's our FBI. So they send that list over. Stacia then forwards it on and says to the rest of the Twitter team, the FBI San Francisco Emergency Operations Center. Oh, gosh, what a stupid title. That's how you know they don't do any emergency or any operations there, because they put it in the title. They sent us the attached report of 207 tweets they may believe to be in violation of our policies. Wow, 207 tweets. It's almost like they're Twitter moderators or something. They attached a whole stinking spreadsheet on this thing. Thank you, Stacia. That's what our Federal Bureau of Investigation is doing. Email after email came from the San Francisco office from Elvis Chan, heading into the election, often adorned with an Excel attachment. Hi, Stacia. Our FBI Baltimore identified these Twitter handles and tweets which appear to provide misleading information on time, place, and manner of voting in the upcoming elections. We believe these may violate your terms of service and wanted to bring them to your attention. We would appreciate any feedback you have regarding this matter. Thanks. Another spreadsheet. Tweets, 9/24/2020. There were so many government requests that Twitter employees had to improvise a system for prioritizing and triaging them. Stacia sends this over October 28th. Oh my gosh, the election is right around the corner. They're getting these requests from the government all the time. It's like insane. Spreadsheets and stuff. Doesn't Twitter have their own moderation team? What's Yoel Roth doing? I thought he was the head of trust and safety. He can't manage his own platform. He's got to get help from the FBI. It says, Stacia. She works for Twitter. She says, hi, everybody. I hope you're both well. I wanted to reach out about election-related escalations. October 28th, things are heating up right now. We've got the Hunter Biden story that needs to be suppressed. People are being banned and nuked off of Twitter left and right. I think Kayleigh McEnany's gone at this point, or getting real close. James Woods was gone, right? They are censoring people left and right. We've already covered all of this in the prior Twitter files. This is from Stacia. They're having a lot of difficulty fulfilling all this stuff. It says, hi, executives. I want to reach out about election-related escalations. You know, as you know, with the adoption of the Unified Escalation Tool and the deprecation of the Go Elections Escalations Tool, we have been sending all election-related requests directly to Get Support for a review. But Stacia says, we're having some issues with the backlog impacting our election efforts. The FBI wants us to censor everything, and we're having a difficult time. The folks on this email represent the DC public policy, legal, and comms teams working on elections. Generally, we are the ones escalating the high priority stuff, whether it's high profile coming directly from government partners. Specifically, Pub Policy and I escalate reports from the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, state election officials, or the Election Integrity Project run by Alex Stamos. Comms escalates a lot of content tied to press inquiries about election issues. They say, is there some way we can figure out an accommodation to prioritize the reports we escalate, particularly in light of the deprecation of the old tool? Although every hashtag tweet is valued, I believe it is likely that our reports are the most credible and most urgent, at least for the next week. Really appreciate any assistance or guidance you can provide. Thanks, Stacia. Okay, so Stacia is saying, like, this is a request to her superiors. It's like, hey, guys, you want me to, all of these requests are coming in. I think you should prioritize mine. Other people are great. Twitter's great. And there's a lot of other issues. But I am specifically, okay, Stacia, I'm working with FBI, DHS, state elections, and some election integrity project run by Alex Stamos. Which is evidently some computer scientist professor at Stanford, former chief security officer at Facebook. Yeah. Okay. So typical. Yeah. Okay. So a little bit more about this fellow. This is Alex Stamos. I'd never heard of him. This guy is a computer scientist, adjunct professor at Stanford. He's a former chief security officer at Facebook. His planned departure from the company following disagreement with executives about how to address the Russian government's use of its platform to spread misinformation. And that's why he left. So he's a big censor is basically my opinion of what it sounds like his work is involved in. So that's the guy that they're working with at Twitter, which makes total sense. All right. So FBI, DHS, state election, and Alex Stamos. Got it. Can we prioritize our work so that we get the first bite at the apple? Matt continues. He says the FBI was clearly tailoring searches to Twitter's policy. The complaints were almost always depicted somewhere as a possible terms of service violation, you know, even in the subject line, because we know how much they hate that. Elvis sends this one over. Oh, hey, sorry. Somebody was late to school this day. Somebody was late to class. Maybe you should tardy them or something. Are you allowed to do that? Says Elvis Chan. Are you allowed to say that? He's sending over notifications. What a weird job. What a weird job. You're an isn't being an FBI agent like a cool thing to do? Like you're an FBI agent, like you do cool stuff. Elvis Chan is sending over Excel files with bad tweets almost on a regular basis. Embarrassing. Twitter executives noticed that the FBI appeared to be assigning personnel to look for Twitter files. An email came in November 3rd, just a few days before the election. Stacia sent this over to Jim Baker, ex-FBI lawyer. Says, hey, Jim, they got some folks in the Baltimore field office and at the HQ that are just doing keyword searches for violations. Okay, like literally. This is probably the 10th request I've dealt with in the last 5 days, but I never typically include a huge distribution on it because there wasn't really a need for this kind of visibility. Let me know if you have any other questions. Okay, so the FBI is like an annoying ex-girlfriend or something, just sending text or ex-boyfriend for Stacia. Sending him text. Remove this, remove this, remove this. She's like, it's the 10th request for crying out loud. Good Lord. Enough already. Even ex-FBI lawyer Jim Baker agreed. Said, odd that they're searching for violations of our policies. Why are they doing that? Also odd that they're searching for violations of our policies. Because they're using it as an in. They don't care about those jokes. They care about getting access to you so that they can compromise you. Have you ever seen a spy movie ever? They never go in and say, can I have your entire account, please? Your entire bank account, please? I also need access to that art. They never do that. It's always this slow little drip. Or you bump into each other at the mall. Oh, you dropped your purse. Let me pick that up for you. Oh, next thing you know, you're robbing the Louvre. So it's a slow drip. Jim Baker knows exactly what they're doing, but finds it odd because, you know, he wasn't a great FBI employee. The New York FBI office even sent requests for user IDs and handles of a long list of accounts named in a Daily Beast article. Senior executives say that they are supportive and completely comfortable giving you anything you need about them. Elvis Chan got an email July 20th, 11:41 a.m. Says the article and names associated with the Twitter request. Elvis, the Daily Beast article and the associated names went back over there. It says right-wing media outlets were duped by a Middle East propaganda campaign. So they went and they tracked down the users for Elvis. And I don't know who sent this email, but somebody sent them user information. Joel Roth also got an email. It says, re-upping our internal conversation, any objections to sending the list of user IDs and handles? I'm comfortable doing so. August 19th, 10:04 a.m. And the email got sent. FBI got what they wanted. Matt says, it seemed to strike no one as strange that a foreign influence task force was forwarding thousands of mostly domestic reports along with DHS about the fringiest materials. Here's something they shared. The American report, and Biden's going to do this, and just like Obama did, and Mary Fanning wrote this article in February 2020, October 31st. That's what they linked. FBI sends that in and wants it gone. Foreign meddling has been the justification for this. Twitter executives were dragged to Capitol Hill, called in to testify. New York Times wrote an article. Their headline says, "Tech executives are contrite about election meddling, but make few promises on Capitol Hill." Taibbi says that was neat that they went there and testified, right? Jack Dorsey sat there and said, "No, we're not interfering with anything." "Oh, Mr. Senator." Remember Zuckerberg, too, said senator every time he's opened his mouth. Senator, senator, senator. Weird. But there's not actually anything happening. It's just a big show. It's like going to the circus, right? The government bureaucrats, they bring in some people. They all fake like they're doing something. A bunch of people get fundraising. It's like this fundraising cycle. "We're going to fight big tech. Donate to support." Okay. But behind the scenes, Twitter executives struggled against government claims of foreign interference supposedly occurring on their platform. You see, this looks like a ticket that was created August 9th. There's an IRA account on Reddit. This was a project. This was looks like it was closed. Taibbi says, but now the Twitter files show that executives at Twitter were under constant pressure to validate theories of foreign influence, and they were unable to find evidence for those key assertions. An email came out March 8th, 2022. It says, "Hi, so-and-so. After I reviewed the accounts and found no links to Russia, obviously, I asked so-and-so on this ticket blank, and this was his answer." It says, quote, "Thanks for tagging in the workflow. For my checks, I could not find any indicators to suggest that the account blank is from Russia. Even the other phone-linked accounts to blank and blank does not have indicators to suggest it's a Russian proxy. Did checks via domain tools for IP address resolves. Did email checks for OS intelligence. However, going by the content and the narrative coming from the account, it's definitely pro-Russian, and it could be a Russian proxy." And so they say, "I can brainstorm with so-and-so to see if we can dig deeper and try to find a stronger connection, but don't see anything. Because maybe it's just a person who has an opinion about Russia, which used to be legal in this country. I hope it still is. You can have opinions about foreign wars and about things like climate change and about things like medical shots that go into your body. You're allowed to have opinions on that. But what you see being concocted here is a narrative that this is Russian misinformation, that there's some sort of nefarious, you know, KGB operation going on or something. We'll just keep digging," they say. Another email came out. It says, "Hey, so-and-so, I looked into this one here. Didn't find any exact naming matches and really any information to link the Reddit accounts to any on-platform presence at Twitter. There was one account that has an incredibly tenuous circumstantial chance." Okay, all of that is in italics. "An incredibly tenuous circumstantial chance," which is like jackpot for FBI agents. They're like, "Oh, perfect. That's exactly what we need. Let's go to the New York Times and tell them." It's like Putin. It's like, okay, perfect. Trump probably did it. Putin's behind it all. "Of being related to documenting the account. So just in case we ever need to come back to it, it was created in a similar time frame. It has a Russian login and a suspect English name." Okay, so they're just gathering a bunch of evidence in case they need to concoct some sort of justification later. Incredibly tenuous circumstantial chance. Why would you even mention that? Incredibly tenuous circumstantial chance. I might use that in court. A judge, you know, look, did he do it? Did he do it? Ladies and gentlemen, it is true that there is an incredibly tenuous circumstantial chance. But I don't think that would go over well. It's not good. Not good. All right. "No real matches using the info," former trust and safety chief Yoel Roth said in another case, noting some links were, quote, "clearly Russian," but another was a house rental in South Carolina. "No real matches using most of the info," says Yoel. "The only thing that did turn up was something was the IP addresses and the accounts are using multiples from the provided. But even then, nothing looked particularly violative. Some clearly Russian, though, but also included an account for a house rental in South Carolina." Yoel says, "Not really worth taking out, but there are two personas linked to two clusters they might be interested in. Both appear to be Russian-like names. However, I wouldn't even call that a slam dunk since it was based on IP data, and I think at least one of the returned accounts formed the IP data. doesn't at all look related. So they're just trying to find Russian sourced Twitter accounts. In another case, Joel Roth concludes that a series of Venezuelan pro-Maduro accounts are unrelated to Russia's Internet Research Agency because they're too high volume. This email comes. It says to Joel, this is from Joel. Joel's responding. He says, hey, thanks for reaching out. A couple things from a quick review. A few of the accounts whose tweets appear in your list are not Russia linked. In February 2019, we re-released our IRA-linked datasets, excluding a number of accounts that were operated out of Venezuela. Those accounts were extremely high-volume tweeters, generally using automation in a way that was pretty uncharacteristic of a lot of IRA activity. We have a very high confidence that they are not linked to IRA or Russia in any form. The current official datasets you can download from us do not include these accounts in the Russian archive, and instead include them in a giant January 2019 release of Venezuelan activity. If you download the unhashed Venezuelan release, you should be able to cross-reference and exclude. Joel says, also, at least a couple of the tweets I spot-checked were deleted by the users themselves. When we first published our archives of Russian activity, we indicated that we excluded tweets deleted prior to the suspension of the account amounting to less than a 1% decrease in volume of tweets. We had to exclude them due to legal constraints, but again, the volume there would be a very small part of the overall Russian activity. If you see something different after excluding the Venezuelan accounts, let me know, and I can dig back in. Thanks, Joel. Man, they're really searching for these Russians, but they can't find them anywhere they turn. The Venezuelans were extremely high-volume tweeters. In another key email, Matt tells us, news that the State Department was making a wobbly public assertion of Russian influence led an executive at Twitter, the same one with the OGA past, OGA meaning CIA, to make a damning admission. This came back out from somebody to somebody, copying Joel, October 1st, 5:19 p.m. It says, yep, InfoBrix is an entity that we've received previous notice on. Though if recollection serves, government partners have never been so specific as to say that it was directly controlled by the GRU. BRICS is an inherently Russian-dominated economic organization, so it was always likely that a website and Twitter account designed to promote it would be directed by the Kremlin. Due to a lack of technical evidence on our end, I've generally left it be, waiting for more evidence. I think that our window on that is closing, given the government partners are becoming more aggressive on attribution and reporting on it. I'm going to go ahead with suspension and marking the domain as unsafe. Okay, so this ex-CIA guy evidently is nuking Russian Twitter accounts. Rebel Inside was a new one for me too. Not even sure what the goal of that account could possibly be, but other than to highlight unrest in other areas of the world other than Russia. I've already suspended it and marked its domain as unsafe, right? So the account can get nuked and it can stop you from linking, right? If you linked to an unsafe domain, Twitter will tell you that. You're about to go to a Russian website. Are you sure you want to do that? You want to read something that might hurt your brain? It's unsafe. You can't go. You can't leave here. Go back over here. Go follow Joe Biden and Karine Jean-Pierre. Matt continues. He says the translation is more aggressive. Government partners saying that it was closing Twitter's window of independence. Other government agencies ended up sharing intelligence through the FBI and FIDF, not just with Twitter, but Yahoo, Twitch, Cloudflare, LinkedIn, even Wikimedia, all of these entities. We assess the following links are also part of the IRA's efforts, linking a ton of different sources. And this is an updated document. You can see it's going to Apple, it's going to Facebook and Meta, it's going to Reddit and LinkedIn. Unclassified start of the text. This information is provided only for intelligence purposes in an effort to develop potential investigative leads. It cannot be used in connection with any foreign or domestic court proceedings or for any other legal proceedings. They write to all of those companies, Apple, Facebook, Reddit, LinkedIn. We've previously passed you information that highlighted as part of Russian mogul Preskirov's Internet Research Agency, the attempt to denigrate French President Emmanuel Macron. They're trying to denigrate him. And their plans are to expose its own troll farms in so-and-so. Okay. So they're updating all of the big tech companies. Matt says, former CIA agent and whistleblower John Kiriakou believes he recognizes the formatting of those reports, the one we just looked at. Looks right on to me, he says, noting that what was cut off above the tear line was the originating CIA office and all of the copied offices. He's saying that right above this tear line. The tear line must be used as is. No changes to the text language are permitted. So he says right above this, there should be something else. The originating CIA office and all of the copied offices. Many people wonder if internet platforms receive direction from intelligence agencies about moderation and foreign policy news stories. It appears Twitter did, in some cases, by the FBI. These reports are far more factually controversial than their domestic counterparts. One Intel report lists accounts tied to Ukraine neo-Nazi propaganda. This includes assertions that Joe Biden helped orchestrate a coup in 2014 and put his son on the board of Burisma. Wow. So is that what that Ukraine censorship was all about? Before the war even started, before the invasion even started? They were censoring this stuff before 2022. Here's what they were focused on. There's a suspected Russian troll farm sharing Ukraine propaganda. Monitoring indicates that a Russian troll farm is propagating disinformation on Twitter about the Ukrainian government to support Russian actions in Ukraine. Here's the spike of the data. Key findings. There were 999 Twitter profiles linked to Russian propaganda farms. Yeah, so they want to stop Russian propaganda by becoming an extension of propaganda, by propagandizing America, by shoving us stories that only we can see, that they want us to see, and by censoring our speech. Ukraine neo-Nazi propaganda, right? They're really focused on that. Another report asserts a list of accounts accusing the Biden administration of corruption in a vaccine, and saying that this is also part of Russia. They also assess with high confidence that the IRA was Russia was responsible in mid-February for producing social media stories that the Biden administration was selling the vax to certain countries. Often intelligence came in the form of brief reports followed by long lists of accounts. Accounts were deemed to be pro-Maduro, pro-Cuba, pro-Russia. This one had over 1,000 accounts marked for digital execution. So Elvis Chan is busy typing away, you know, saving America, and he's drafting new spreadsheets. Suspected bot accounts. These accounts were found to be linked to Maduro. Nuke them. One report says a site that was documenting purported rights abuses committed by Ukrainians, saying it's directed by Russian agents. So those stories are fake, right? Unclassified. We assess that the tragedy of Donbass, DonbassTragedy.info, a website documenting purported human rights abuses committed by Ukrainians, is directed by the Russian general staff. So that has to go, obviously. That's illegal. Can't have those stories. Now, intel about the shady origin of these accounts might be true, but so might at least some of the information in them about neo-Nazis, rights and abuses in Donbass, and even about our own governments. Should we block such material? It's a great point, Matt. Exactly the point that we're making. You're allowed to have opinions about that. You're allowed to say that type of stuff. This is a difficult speech dilemma. Should the government be allowed to try to prevent Americans and others from seeing pro-Maduro or anti-Ukrainian accounts? The government allowing you to not see certain stories, to not view the news, to have opinions or get opinions from other people? No. In fact, the First Amendment says so. Free speech. They can't censor us. Often intel reports are just long lists of newspapers, tweets, or even YouTube videos guilty of anti-Ukraine narratives. Now, all this have coming, of course, this stuff is coming out now after the invasion. This is now August 2022. So now that it's in full swing, we're in full-blown war now, that the U.S. is funding to the tune of over $100 billion, now this starts to make sense. But why were they so interested in it in 2020? I mean, really, the only threat back then was the exposure of the corruption. But they were very concerned that leaks might come out. The Russian mogul is operating the IRA, and they want all of these YouTube addresses to get nuked. This one's going over to Meta, Reddit, LinkedIn, and Apple. Sharing YouTube shorts. Wonder what YouTube's doing about some of this. Same here. Also, Twitter links. The IRA was responsible for the following posts and controlled the underpinning account handles, also over there. More here, all unclassified. End of text. Taibbi says that sometimes, not always, Twitter and YouTube blocked the accounts. But now we know for sure what Roth meant by the Bureau, and by extension, the IC. Yole sent an email, privileged and confidential, to his team. Yole says, "Hi, team. The questions we received are attached. I'm frankly perplexed by the requests here, which seem more like something we'd get from a congressional committee than from the Bureau. There's a big discussion to be had about state-controlled media, which will be impacted by the label launch later this month, but I'm not particularly comfortable with the Bureau, and by extension, the intelligence community, demanding written answers here. What's your perspective on how best to navigate? Thanks. Yole." Yeah, and this was a letter, right? We've covered all of this previously in the prior Twitter files, but when Twitter was giving answers to the FBI that the FBI didn't like, they demanded written answers. They said, "Hang on a minute. We want to know why you're not coming to the conclusions that we want you to come to. Facebook came to the conclusions we told them to come to. Google and YouTube came to the conclusions that we told them to come to. Why haven't you not come to the conclusions?" Ultimately, they did. The line, says Matt, between misinformation and distorting propaganda is thin. Yeah, it's very thin. Are we comfortable with so many companies receiving so many reports from a, quote, more aggressive government? I'm not. The CIA has yet to comment on the nature of its relationship to big tech companies like Twitter. Twitter had no input into anything I did or wrote. The searches in this story were carried out by third parties, so I saw what I saw could be limited, says Matt. Continue to watch Barry Weiss, Schellenberger, and Li Fang, and this space for more. Issues coming up ranging from COVID to Twitter's relationship to Congress, and more in the next Twitter files drop. And yeah, another peering inside. The veil is, of course, lifted continually by these Twitter files and more disgusting behavior from our government censoring Americans at every turn. Of course, we will continue to cover that and more. I hope you do join us for the next Twitter files drop. Thank you for liking this video and subscribing, following wherever it is you're watching it. And we'll look forward to seeing you on the next one. All right, my friends. Well, that is it for the Christmas show on the day. We got a couple interesting holiday goodies that dropped, the Twitter files 9, and of course, the Carrie Lake election decision. But now, my friends, it is time to hear from you and to see what you have to say, of course, over at watchingthewatchers.locals.com. And while we're here, let's always remember to support our very special sponsors of the show. We're going to take a quick beverage break and say thank you to Four Patriots before we jump into your comments and your questions on this lovely Christmas. My friends, a food shortage could be coming. Even in the United States, experts have written about this as recently as July. Drought, inflation, even new policies are pushing America's food supply near its breaking point. That's why survival food is more important.
Cheers, my friends. Merry Christmas.
Ever. And you can create your own stockpile of the best-selling Four Patriots survival food kits ever. This is not ordinary food. We're talking about good for 25 years, super survival food, hand-packed right in family-owned facilities in the United States, giving jobs to over 200 Americans. The kits are compact, they're sturdy, they're water-resistant, and they stack easily. They have different delicious breakfast, lunches, and dinners, and you can make these meals in less than 20 minutes. Just add boiling water, simmer, and serve. And right now, you can go to 4patriots.com. Use code Robert to get 10% off your first purchase on anything in the store, including this 3-month survival kit. You'll get their famous guarantee for an entire year after your order, plus free shipping on orders over $97. They're called Four Patriots because a portion of every sale is donated to charities who support our veterans and their families. Go to 4patriots.com. Use code Robert to get 10% off. That's 4patriots.com. Use code Robert. Start building your own stockpile today. That's right, everybody. Get your food. Get your survival food. Get those calories, put them in a closet in case you need them. All right, my friends. Well, that is it for the show. It's a beautiful Christmas day. And I wanted to say thank you for those amazing super chats that came in. So let's jump into those super chats. And of course, we'll stick around for the locals after party. Oh, and I forgot. Before we leave, we have to check in with our very, very incredible meme from our friend at Sleepy Dog Lee on Twitter. This is from our friend Paul at Sleepy Dog Lee on Twitter. And you can see this is the recently released edition of Elvis Chan, the FBI agent. Wow. Wow. Real life FBI agent. Wow. Delete that. Delete this. Seventh floor club over at the FBI. FBI approved. You see, we have a very nice smiley face down there at the bottom. The official Twitter action figure. Get yours today. DNC/FBI Elvis Chan. Thanks, Tweep. You're the best. Wow. It's great. Yeah, and you can get yours today by going over and visiting at Sleepy Dog Lee down there in the bottom right. Yeah, it's a Christmas, it's a Christmas toy. It's a very Christmas miracle. All right, so that's Elvis Chan. Delete that. Delete this. Amazing. All right, so thank you to Paul for that one. And of course, we'll see a lot more of Elvis Chan. I have no doubt about that. He will be coming back. I'm sure of it. All right, my friends. And so I wanted to say thank you for the super chats that came in today. And you know, okay. Anyways, these are the super chats. This is what came in. And everybody, thank you very much for being so generous here today. Loveologist was in the house a couple days ago. This morning or today, we got Trump is here. He says, hey, Rob, where is the ugly sweater? Oh, you know, it's, I don't know where it went. Somebody mentioned that I probably have one and I don't know where it went, to be honest. I kind of missed that one, huh? Yeah. Okay. Next year, Trump, we'll come back and do it again. CA Human is here, says so many stocking stuffers. Yeah. It's a lot of news to get to today. CA Human. Thank you for sending in the super chat. What'd you guys get in your stockings? Here's what I got. Here's something I got. Look at this. I brought it out here for the show. Okay. It's a magical cube. And then when you open it up, if I can open it, once you open it, what's cool about this is it will never go back into a cube again. Isn't that fun? So once it's open, that's basically it. Okay. So it'll take you about 15, 20 minutes. And then you ruin your toy. All right. So that's fun. Okay. So I'm just kidding. It's easy to put it back together. All right. But you know, it's a cube. It's fun. It makes a lot of different shapes. Thank you for that one, CA Human. Hopefully you got some beautiful stocking stuffers as well. Rose is here, says you are amazing. Thank you, Rose. Very nice of you to send that one in. I think you're amazing too. And I hope you're having a beautiful Christmas as well. Thank you for the sticker. Fred is here. Fred Pedamonte says, the 1916 AZ gubernatorial election was so close that it came to tens of votes. And the election was overturned. Wow. So I didn't know that. So that's a little bit of a fun fact, right? The judge said that nothing was like overturned. I think the judge was probably sort of splicing that, right? He was saying that nothing got overturned because of fraud. Nothing was overturned, but maybe a recount reversed the course of the election, I think was sort of his argument. And where did I mark that one? Four elements. I was trying to see if there was law here. Burden showing that the case falls within the terms of the statute. Yeah. That's an interesting fact, right? I think the judge would probably distinguish that on the basis that it was like a recount, right? It was a recount. It was a close call. It was reversed, maybe reversed. But I don't know, you know, did the court overturn it? I don't know. Fred, if there's a case on that, I'd be curious to read it because the judge might have missed it. Very curious. IB is here, says Times Magazine released an article on 2/4/21 called Secret History of the Shadow Campaign that saved the 2020 election. They confessed says IB. We read that. We read that whole story here. Yeah, it was the labor leader, right? They had Zoom meetings. They had the whole thing plotted out. And guess what? It worked. Now, look, we've talked about this a lot. And I think the Republicans are in serious trouble for a while because they don't have an answer to Mark Elias. They don't have an answer to really anything the Democrats are doing. And we saw that here, especially in this litigation. It's pretty bad litigation. Not good. But don't worry about that, my friends, because things, you know, freedom is going to win on the long arc of history. Like a lot of this stuff piles up and it feels very demoralizing and very like down. It's like, oh man, Carrie Lake lost. FBI's rigging everything. The whole country seems like, you know, it's like fake. There's no money. Everything is bankrupt. They still pass $1.65 trillion. Like it's lunacy. But the weight of their incompetence will collapse upon them. In the meantime, we have to keep living according to our values, keep adhering to the principles that are America, freedom of speech, and so on. If we adhere to those principles, the dark side is going to collapse. And so we have to think about becoming sovereign individuals, about fortifying ourselves, becoming anti-fragile in a collapsing world. And that's what we're doing here. Things will, look, America is not the federal government. It's not. It feels like that because they want you to think that. But America is our countrymen. It's our brothers and sisters. It's our families. It's our societies. It's the things that we do. It's our the people we trade with, engage in commerce with. It's our places we worship. That's America. It's not Mitch McConnell, Joe Biden, and Kevin McCarthy. Okay, it's not America. They are just this disgusting government that is on the back of America. And as soon as they collapse in on their own incompetence, we're going to be a lot more free. Might be a little bit, you know, difficult and tiresome to live through that, but it's going to happen because if you look on a long arc, people want freedom. Dictators and totalitarian systems collapse, and they're going to continue to collapse. We just have to keep persevering. And every time we hear bad stories like this, and every time there's like this bad development, it's intentionally bad, and it's sort of created, right? We talk about these things because they're bad or they're good, right? We talk about them because they stand out. But every day, my friends, every day, there are millions and billions of quiet people not doing big things, big celebratory things, not losing big, not winning big, just living according to their values, according to their societies, their principles. Billions. So rest assured, we're all in very good company. And even though it might feel lonely out there, there is a quiet rumble of freedom and true Americans out there. And that's what I think is going to be a beautiful rebirth when the time is right. Right now is not the time. There's a lot of people here who, you know, the country is going to continue on, I think, its current path for a while. But we know where this road goes because it's impossible to do what they are doing and have a cohesive society under their vision. I'm very optimistic about it. I think that things are going to get better after, you know, things are a little tricky, but I'm optimistic about it. All right, my friends, that is it. Oh, we had Wood Precision Arms is in the house. Says that was Maricopa's game. Sent the printers not to work because they wanted those votes in door three. This gives them control whether the votes show up or not. How could the voter prove they dropped it off? That's a good question. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. Because it didn't articulate anything. It didn't record anything specifically, to my knowledge. It was just like a drawer, like a physical drawer. Like it was like an envelope box. So I guess they would print you the ballot and they'd watch you put it in and they'd say that counted. Because if you left, you would have checked out of the ballot, right? If you get the ballot and you leave, you have to check the ballot out, is what they said. So I think once you're checked in and you get handed the ballot, that's considered a vote. But I get your point. If they put it in box three, how do you know it's really counted? Yeah, I think it's an interesting point, right? I think it's a big problem. I think that the suppression in and of itself was a gigantic problem. It's re ipsa loc. It's the thing that speaks for itself. It was a catastrophe. Everybody knows it's a catastrophe. You don't have access to the evidence to go prove the catastrophe. So what are you supposed to do? Lose, I guess, which is what has happened here. But that, my friends, was it from the Super Chats over on the YouTubes. Thank you very much, YouTube, my friends. We had another one come in at the start of the show over from our Rumble friends. Shout out to Michael Swade. Says, Merry Christmas, Rob. Thanks for sharing your Christmas with us. Merry Christmas to you, Michael Swade. And thank you for sharing your Christmas with us as well. Thanks for being here with us and hanging out as we got to go through some of the Christmas goodies. But all right, my friends, we are going to leave it right there. Let's check out our Twitter. Let's see how Twitter's doing. We're trying to support Elon, you know, and stream over on Twitter. Oh my goodness. We've got 6 viewers over there. Holy moly. It's totally crazy. As you can see, it's absolute madness over there on Twitter. Let's go see what's going on over there. Hey, Paul's in the house. Paul says, Merry Christmas. Santa's hanging down the Christmas tree. Had a couple little extra cookies and milk there. Stuck. Shout out to Paul Mino. And by the way, this is Sleepy Dog Lee. This is the purveyor of the very good Elvis Chan meme. Sheila Mays is in the house. Says, Merry Christmas, Robert. Merry Christmas to you, Sheila Mays. Glad you're here with us. Wilhelm also says, Hey, Rob, thanks for the continued coverage. Thank you, Wilhelm. Merry Christmas to you, Diesel. And Ferris says, Why does it have to be intentional? Good question, Ferris. Well, it's basically what the law says. And the judge, you know, malfeasance, you have to find a person who was the malfeasant person, which sort of implies intent, right? The law kind of didn't say it, at least in the judge's decision, but then he's sort of reading it into the law. You know, if you have to identify a person, the person had to do something. And so we say that that mental state was intent. Ferris says, wow, insurance companies should use this to not pay thief claims. Unless you know who did the stealing, your claim is denied. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you shift the burden to everybody else so that you don't have anything to prove. Carrie Lake needs to prove fraud. How does she do that? Well, she's got to figure it out, but she can't have access to the fraudulent materials. Otherwise, that's burden shifting, right? So the government is basically immune. Oh my gosh, we've got 8 viewers now. Things are crazy. I wonder if one of those is mine. I don't know. But if we leave it here for a quick minute, then what we'll see is the mirror hall of infinity, of eternity, as the windows go back all the way to the dawn of time. And it's just the Merry Christmas extravaganza all the way to the beginning. Look at all of those. One after another. It's beautiful. John Doe is asking in YouTube about case 22360, which is the Brunson case. And John Doe, we covered that case at length on Rumble. We didn't actually do it on YouTube because of the allegations in that case, but we covered it at length. It's on Rumble. If you search 22360 or the Brunson case, you'll find it. I don't know that there's any updates on that one other than the fact that it's going to be brought in front of the court at some point in time, but you can go check that out if you'd like to do that. But that, my friends, is it for us on the day. We are going to hop over to Locals for a little bit of an after party on this beautiful Christmas. But I hope you have a beautiful Christmas. Hopefully you had some time to reflect with friends, family, or solo and get into the holiday spirit a little bit. Before we wrap up, I want to say thank you to our sponsors of the show. Of course, shout outs to 4Patriots, 4Patriots.com. Use promo code Robert to check out and get 10% off everything in the store. It's too late to get it for Christmas, okay? But if you have like a delayed Christmas present, I missed you, sorry. Send them some survival food so they don't starve to death. And also our law firm, the R&R Law Group. You know, the holidays, unfortunately, sometimes people get into a little bit of trouble out there and we can help. Good people in Arizona charged with crimes, send them our direction, 480-787-0394, online, rrlawaz.com. We love to help good people, and we appreciate your referrals to us. They do keep us busy. Shout out to the mods in the house. Of course, we always love Vienti Kiss. K Bean, Just Cause, Lean in the house. I thought I saw Lean come by earlier. Playin' Hooky, Ronnie Cole, Zulu, and of course, Geo Mancy. But that, my friends, is it for us on the day. We're going over to Locals for a little bit of a Christmas after party. Come on over and join us if you'd like to do that. But I want to say thank you, everybody, for joining us on this beautiful Christmas. Very Merry Christmas. I really do hope you have had an amazing day. Have an amazing night. Do whatever it is that brings you joy and cheer. It's a beautiful day. I'm grateful for the time that we had together here. We'll probably be back here tomorrow. I think it's officially, people are celebrating Christmas officially. You know, it's the official holiday tomorrow. We'll see what the news holds for us. But, you know, I kind of don't like missing shows. We'll see. We'll see what we have tomorrow. But in the meantime, my friends, I hope you have a beautiful rest of your Christmas, a beautiful, sweet slumber. Eat extra cookies. Have that extra piece of fudge or toffee or whatever the little cookies are. You deserve it. You've all been very good this year. Probably. But I hope you have a blessed evening, really a tremendous evening. Very Merry Christmas, everybody. Locals, we'll be back over in about 30 seconds. Everybody else, I will see you on the next one when I hope to see you right here so that together with your help, we can shine that big, beautiful spotlight of accountability and transparency down upon our system with the hope of finding justice. Merry Christmas, my friends. Have a tremendous evening. I'll see you right back here on the next one. Bye-bye.